Okay, we're recording. Yeah, but anyway, you were saying?
For me, it's been very, very frustrating because I am completely bilingual. So I pick up stuff equally from English language international media. And then I read a lot of Chinese language media. And it used to be that I read pan-green Chinese media. So there wasn't too much of a contradiction between the international media and what I was reading in Taiwan. But then as I moved on to the Pan Blue media and even exploring sources from China, then I just saw that people were completely like not even on the same page. Mm. And it's pretty easy for me to track, right? Like, okay, so A said this, B said that, C said that about a particular issue. Who's right and who's wrong? After a couple of years, it's going to become pretty blatantly obvious that Western media is constantly getting surprise Pikachu face because something they predicted didn't happen the way they predicted it. But I think when you have that viewpoint, then it's kind of hard to.
Let me ask you, why do you have that viewpoint in terms of being troubled by a difference in media narratives? Because I feel like the easy way out of that is to just sort of pick a tribe and say, like, these are my people and they're right, and opposing narratives are, propaganda or, dishonest,
Yeah, I think there's probably two things that made it untenable for me to be inside that bubble. The first thing is I lived in Taiwan at a very specific time and came back at a very specific time, right? So I was born in 1980 and I left in 89. So I was about 9 years old. But I was a smart little girl. I already knew a lot about the world.
Where did you go to at that age?
Australia.
Okay.
So I kind of knew a lot. I knew how to read. So I knew, our textbooks, our identity, it's like we were supposed to bring light back to the motherland to save our Chinese compatriots who were suffering under the commie bandits and didn't have their freedom. And we had our freedom, even though
Were your parents Weishinren? Like, did they come
they
over?
Were. And they were Weishinren.
Okay.
And I never, thought too much about that as a kid, though, because you don't really. So it's possible that a Benjamin family wouldn't have had the same, but frankly, they didn't even talk about it that much. It was in school, you learned about it. You're Chinese. That's what everybody learned. Then I really didn't think too much about my identity. If you had asked me, I would have said that I'm, a Chinese person, but I'm from Taiwan, not China. And I really didn't think about it. I gradually felt Taiwan changing as I kept coming back. Obviously, I actually lived here for a fair chunk of my 20s, so before going back to the U.S. But I just didn't really worry about Taiwanese politics so much.
I missed that. So you went to the U.S. for a bit after that?
Well, basically, oh my goodness, we have to talk about.
Actually, you know what? I'm glad we actually got all that recorded because this is leading to a tweet of yours about identity that really made me interested in Angelica's recent sort of tweet storm, which I find fascinating. All different topics, because it's stuff that I think about a lot. And the reason it interests me is because I do think in a way it comes back to Taiwan, right?
Mm-hmm.
But why don't we introduce you for a sec? Like, just tell the people who you are so they know who I'm talking to and how to find you on Twitter.
Sure. Hello, everybody. My name is Angelica Ong, and I live in Taipei, where I am a pro-nuclear activist. I was previously a business reporter.
Pro-nuclear as in energy, not weapons, right?
Yes, pro-nuclear energy, yeah. Definitely. The good kind. And it's very sad because Taiwan last nuclear reactor is powering down as we speak. It's 10 p.m. on Saturday, May 17th. So this is nuclear phase out day for Taiwan. Wow. So it's a very sad day for me. And you can find me on Twitter at Angelica Ong, O-U-N-G. And I am the manic nuclear scheme girl.
A great follow, in my opinion, because like I said, and we were just talking before, like, you do tweet, I think, from an authentically tribalist perspective, and which is getting rarer these days on Twitter. And you had a tweet about your recent thoughts about identity and how you considered yourself maybe a rootless cosmopolitan, might be one way to put it.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that this is something that's very common to people from Taiwan. I was born in the US, but I still consider myself from Taiwan in a sense, because all of the rest of my family, including my sister, were born there, and I spent a lot of time there as a child. So I still consider myself somewhat rooted in Taiwan. You know, okay, so I'll tell you this story real quick. So the other day, just the other day, I was in the cafeteria of my building, and I ran into an old friend from like 20 years ago. And I just ran into him in the cafeteria, and he's this guy who is clearly like a rootless cosmopolitan from Taiwan. He's sort of like you when I'm talking to you. Like, I'm not totally sure where he grew up. I know he grew up in a mix of the US in America and a mix in Taiwan. And the last time I saw him, I ran into him completely randomly as well at the office, or not at the office, outside the office, in Hong Kong. And he was just there working, you know, and I was on a business trip, and I just ran into him, and he was working in Hong Kong, and his wife and kids were in Taipei, and now he's working here, and he's got a kid here in college, and his wife and his daughter are still in Taipei, and they go to international school in Taipei, and they want to go to colleges in America. And when he talks to his wife, it's a mix of Mandarin and English. And it's just like this very, caught in the middle sort of existence that they have. And I don't know what to call him. I don't know if he's an American or he's a Taiwanese or he, you know, I don't know what he is.
Well, I actually, yeah, find that kind of upbringing a real blessing for me, because I think I do have multiple identities, and I happen to have moved at a time in my life when it was optimal. I moved away from Taiwan when I was 9 years old. So that was young enough so that I can speak English without much of an accent, but old enough that I already know how to read Chinese characters very well.
Yeah.
So I can fully remain immersed in the culture. So
now, I'm serious. Nine or 10 seems to be the magic age. I know people who moved at like 13 and 14, and then they will be heavily biased towards Chinese.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a first language, and English comes on as a second. It really seems to be the magic age to have both. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was able to, when I moved back to Taiwan in my mid-20s, my Mandarin was obviously very rusty. But because I could read all the characters, now when I write Chinese characters, it's still like I'm a nine-year-old, probably with a smaller vocabulary. But you don't need to write by hand when you can type phonetically.
Right. Yeah.
So you're not hobbled. You have a good basis on which to learn and build. And now I can speak, you know, most people can't tell that I, sometimes they're surprised. Actually, I was quite insulted once in a offshore wind line chat group when I was arguing with somebody, and they're like, "This account is a fraud. Angelica's from America. She doesn't know how to type Chinese that well."
Right.
So,
right.
But yeah, I feel very lucky because I do feel rootless. And in a way, this is how I got in trouble. How I got in trouble is I'm very, very fluent in both English and Chinese. And I'm in these different media bubbles. So it feels really weird for me not to pass pieces of information I know and trust. But mm-hmm. it does get me in trouble because there are some things that are, it is known in the sinosphere and just not accepted at all outside. So, yeah. So at some point, the leakage got so serious that I felt I had no choice but to come out and say that I had some change in my beliefs. And that created a huge shitstorm.
Describe that change. That I'm very curious in. Sure. What were you? What were your? What? So first of all, like, in what sense are we talking about? You know, Taiwan's relative position in the world, or are we talking about viewpoints on modern mainland China? And also, what was the change? You know.
Well, when I came back to Taiwan in 2020, it was because of COVID. And I don't know if you remember that Taiwan was doing an insane amount of aura farming online based on its COVID success. And it was like donating masks to Lithuania and stuff like that. And Taiwan is a country became a meme. And we were all eating freedom pineapples because we don't want China to be putting pressure on Taiwan. And do you remember all that?
I kind of do, yes. Yeah.
So I came back to
this was under Tsai, right?
Yeah, this was under Tsai. And you have to remember, I relocated very, very unexpectedly because of COVID. And I was very, very scared. I didn't know what was going on with my life. I didn't know what I was going to do. I felt stuck in Taiwan for an indeterminate amount of time. And I was also in quarantine. So I watched a lot of YouTube videos and I soaked up a lot of the pan-green media stuff. And it just seemed like, wow, Taiwan is different now. When I left, Taiwan was still kind of like a bit of a backwater, you know, like during the Ma years. And it was kind of, you know, just getting closer with China, but kind of not that interesting. It felt like
it wasn't like a global flashpoint.
It wasn't a global flashpoint. And TSMC was just a company. It did well, but nobody was putting the spotlight on it.
It was so, like, nerd shit. Like, nobody talked about semiconductor.
Like, what is AMD? What is Intel Inside? Like, who? Nobody cared about that stuff.
Yeah.
So I just didn't think that much about it, but I was like, wow. My homeland had a glow up, and how fortunate that I'm here. Even though there's all this surprise and dislocation, this is a good thing. I'm going to make a good thing out of this highly traumatic, unexpected move back to Taiwan. So I really embraced the identity. I went back to my old newspaper, Taipei Times. It was a real, like, Freaky Friday time warp moment because I first started working there in 2005. So I went back to my old newspaper, started covering the business beat, and really started embracing the Taiwanese identity. I was like, oh, cool, we're doing this now. We were Chinese before, but now we're Taiwanese. Mm. I can roll with this. This is like, we're cool. We have a new identity. And as somebody who have moved around a lot, I didn't have a problem with that. It wasn't like I felt offended or, oh yeah, I realize I'm not Chinese after all. It was more like, oh, cool, a new identity. I can pick it up.
Right, I've got a bun in my mouth. But like a breakfast bun. But that is a bit for Weissen and growing up in Taiwan at that time, because I'm like 2 years older than you. I can kind of imagine. It was more drilled into your heads that you were Chinese, right? Like temporary displaced Chinese.
I don't even know if that really mattered that much to me because I was a very independent child and I was not like into, I was not into being obedient to my parents and,
But what I mean is, like, this when you were saying this newfound sense of Taiwanese identity, It was not something that necessarily existed when you were young for you?
No, not at all. I didn't think of myself in that way, in that very political way. I was from Taiwan, and I knew there was a difference between people from Chinese people from Taiwan and Chinese people from China. But there wasn't this separation that was so stark. And while I lived here, I was kind of green when I lived here, 2005 to 2010. I just didn't think about Taiwanese politics that much. To me, it was all nonsense. I couldn't make heads or tails of it. Now I could, and I wish I could go back to that blessed state of innocence, because it is quite convoluted and insignificant at the same time.
So what's your read of Taiwan now in 2025? Like, where are things generally headed? Because Taiwan, in my view, has only become more of a flashpoint.
Yeah.
And it's now the primary, I would say it's the primary locus of confrontation between the U.S. and China. And that's a big deal. That's like a really big role to satisfy in the world. And very rarely do people in America we report about the viewpoints of people in Taiwan, but we don't really care about it. And the reporting on that is just really shallow and motivated.
Yeah.
You know, so what is the reality, do you think?
The reality, it's people are in a pressure cooker type environment. So I felt like when I first arrived on the island, I was very pro-green, and I knew that the KMT were evil. And this was so drilled into me that even though I was a pro-nuclear activist, I was afraid to approach the other pro-nuclear activists on the island because they were KMT. And it's when I finally talked to them and got to know their media that, you know, I think half the work was done there. Once I saw the Pan Blue point of view really clearly, I'm just like, wow, the DPP point of view is really unhinged from reality. It's my belief that all the Pan Blue people in Taiwan and probably most of the pro-TPP people, the white camp, they know what's up, which is that we are entering into this very unstable period of geopolitics. Whether or not the American security partnership was ever solid before, it's not now. It's not now anymore. And even with, let's say, China rises at some point to become a co-superpower with the United States, with Taiwan being right next to China, that makes holding our independence a very, very hard ask. And I think the answer for the Pan-Greens is to just go on and on and on and on about our right to be independent and our identity as a Taiwanese. And more and more, for me at least, can't speak for anybody else, it's becoming increasingly tiresome and increasingly insulting. I don't know if you saw my tweet where I talked about how on the government's website now, they have a very helpful page asking you, describing for you Taiwan's demographics. And it's saying that we have about 2% Taiwanese Aborigine of all those different tribes. And we have about 1.5% new immigrants from all these different countries. And then 96% other. And then it goes on and on about all the tribes, all the places people come from. But they don't say what ethnicity 96% of Taiwanese are. And I can tell you, Taiwan, until the website changed a few days ago, whenever the news broke, Taiwan is 96% Han, as the government website itself admitted just a few days ago.
And that includes most Ben Sungren, right? Like,
most who identify
as Taiwanese.
This is the part that's totally bonkers. Taiwan is actually more of a Han ethno state than China. Mm. We are 96% Han. That is higher than the percentage of Han in China, because in China you have all those ethnic groups, right? You have the Uyghurs, you have the Mongolians. In Taiwan, we have 2% Aborigine and 1.5%, like, I don't know, Vietnamese brides or that sort of thing. They call new immigrants. And then the rest are Han Chinese. We are exceptionally, when I grew up, when I was a little girl, if you can prove you had Han ancestry, that's your golden ticket to get an ROC passport.
Mm-hmm.
So we're literally, until the 90s, a Han ethno state. And now you have a government that's telling you your identity is the rest. Your identity is remainder, leftover. Mm-hmm. It really struck a lot of people as really, really insulting. And also, it kind of feels like we are a part of a playbook of creating a division where there hasn't been before, between China and Taiwan. And
at an ethnic level.
On an ethnic level, yeah. I think it's social engineering. And of course, the pro-Taiwanese side of it are really forgetting where their ancestors come from right now. They're just like, well, what is Han? Han is a very unnuanced label. Han can mean a lot of things. And I was just like, oh my goodness.
Do you think, because like, so my parents were, my family were sort of like KMT official type people, right?
Yeah.
Like they were in the government. And I think that what I see now in terms of the division in between Taiwanese as sort of like an enveloping identity for all of Taiwan,
mm-hmm.
versus in the sense of like it defining it in the negative to we are not Chinese.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, do you feel like I get the feeling that a lot of that is sort of like displaced from an earlier and I think more legitimate political schism between the people in Taiwan who were there prior to the arrival of the KMT and the ensuing sort of like the whole schism in Taiwan against sort of the KMT invaders, right? Like sort of against the Jiangjie's era and all that stuff and all the terrible things that happened in Taiwan. I feel like there was a displacement now where the KMT is seen as sort of like a puppet or a mainland China party.
Yeah.
And that's very strange to me because it makes it super complicated because historically the KMT is sort of the arch enemy of the communists in China. So things are just very
complicated,
right?
But yet it's not, right?
Okay.
Well, think about it. The KMT are an authoritarian, technocratic party. So what was their dream? Their dream was to make China great again. They wanted to be, there was no confusion in their mind that they were Chinese. In fact, they thought they should be in charge of all of China. And they wanted to do a lot of the same things that the Chinese are doing, government, the PRC are doing right now. They like building infrastructure. They like reducing the poverty, the rural-urban poverty gap. They like doing stuff like that, like nerd technocracy shit. So even though they took very different routes to get there, in a weird way, I don't know if there's more differences or more similarities between the Taiwan where I grew up with in the 80s and the China now versus the Taiwan now. I think that's the big difference. I think there's something, this would have been like totally heretical for me to say 2 weeks ago, but you know, I think I can't be canceled anymore. So I might as well, I'm so canceled. I can't get canceled anymore. So I'm just going to say it out loud. The introduction of democracy really Philippinized Taiwan. Before, I think, under the KMT, authoritarian technocracy, we were a country that, well, you know, that had a plan, right? The Republic of China had plans for how to deal with our economic development. We had technocrats who really could accept the responsibility for a project long term, like TSMC. Nobody thought we were in a good shape to do that, because in the 80s, Taiwan was still like thought of as a place to make dolls and cheap umbrellas. Like 80% of the world's Barbie dolls were made in Taiwan. That was when the KMT, I think he was a premier at the time, Sun Yun-shen, he started creating the Hsinchu Technology Park and the ITRI research think tank. And that was the vision for TSMC. And people talk a lot about Morris Chang, but he came later and he was a hired gun. So without these like KMT bureaucrats that really saw the vision for this and took the responsibility for getting it done, we wouldn't have a semiconductor industry. And somehow that's been retconned into, oh, Taiwan was under this terrible authoritarian regime, and then we got democracy and all these good things happened, and magic Morris Chang came back home from America because he was being underestimated at Texas Instruments, and he bought the chips home. He was the Johnny Appleseed of chips or something. I don't know. But it's like, no, dude, that's...
So what you're saying is that there's a revisionist narrative where Taiwan went from like a sort of backwards authoritarian regime, democratized, and then became the sort of modern technological power that it is now. And you're saying that's not really the case. Like the foundation for Taiwan's industrialization and then move into high tech occurred actually prior to democratization, and then
you have to understand the Taiwan economy's real go-go age was in the 80s and 90s. That was when there was a sense of tremendous, like, explosive growth. There's
The East Asian tiger phenomenon. Exactly. I mean, we followed this in the U.S., but mostly via Japan, and less so. I think we were aware of Taiwan, but like Japan really was sort of like the flagship of that era. Absolutely. But Taiwan followed in that wake, right?
Taiwan followed in that wake, but we took a different trajectory. A lot of things happened simultaneously. It's hard to disentangle the cause and effect. One really unfortunate thing that happened was the dynamism kind of faded away. And the Taiwanese were not these, like, I think businessmen of my father's era, they were like almost like pirates in their zeal for entrepreneurism. There's a spirit of the one suitcase salesman, which is basically a Taiwanese business guy who would get a bunch of samples and pack them in a suitcase and go to a show anywhere in the world. And renting a booth would have cost a lot of money, right? But what he would do is he would rent a suite in the hotel and turn it into a little showroom. And then he'll go to the show and walk the floor and find takers and give them his card and then hold little shows in his hotel suite. That was the spirit of making do. That was the spirit of running a business while on the back of a scooter. So that was the entrepreneurial origin story of Taiwan. But by the time I came back to Taiwan in 2000 and For 2005 was already a different story. It was a story of stagnation. Already then, housing prices was getting to be a problem, of wages not keeping up with cost of living. And cost of living in Taiwan is pretty low. If you have a house, it's almost all housing that is making cost of living so difficult for young people. Tuition is cheap, food is cheap. Life is good in Taiwan, except housing, it just makes it difficult for you to exist. But it just seems to be something that can't be controlled. The housing bubble just blew up.
How bad is it, like, in terms of pricing?
Oh my God.
Like, relative to your income, what would it take to buy a 2-bedroom apartment in, you know, I'm not like a high, super high rent area of Taipei, but like,
so it's not as if I've been shopping. So I'm getting a lot of this secondhand. So I won't talk about specific prices, but I will tell you it is totally out of whack, and it is making absolutely impactful decisions in people's personal lives. So for instance, we can't have kids until we get an apartment, but we can't get an apartment because it's so expensive for so long. And then by the time we get the apartment, it's kind of, the couple's getting kind of old to have their first kid, and they might have to get IVF, and maybe it's just one if they're lucky. So definitely it's pushing down the birth rate. And I even heard very sad friend of mine in a couple who wanted to be entrepreneurial, and their parents talked them out of it. And they say, you know, if you buy an apartment, the price goes up every year. If you start a business, you're going to be a sucker because your business could fail. You could lose everything. Or even if it's a success, you're still working your ass off. But you buy an apartment, you just know it's going to go up every year. And so far, it has done so. So now we're on this unsustainable perch where if something bad did happen to the housing market, that would hurt everyone who already got on the housing ladder and have most of their assets locked in housing.
It's creating sort of like a landed versus non-landed class. And
yeah, I think so.
It almost seems like, you know, and I have some personal experience with this just in the form of cousins who are facing this problem. And yeah, it seems like the answer for a lot of them right now, I don't know if this is true or not, but like I sense this with my cousins that there's a lot of pressure to either leave for China or leave for the US. And you know, even within a Taiwanese company, like I got a cousin that works for SanDisk, you know, the memory maker.
Yeah.
And his company was like, you know, if you want a promotion, you're going to either go to Shenzhen or you're going to go to Santa Clara. But you can't stay here if you want a promotion. And he was like, I just want to stay in Taiwan. I don't want to move. So he has to, because he just literally wants to stay in Taiwan, which he considers his home, and he wants to be near his parents and her parent, you know, he's with his wife's parent family and stuff. And they don't even have a kid. I don't know if that's related to the affordability crisis or not, or not sure why, but That was the sort of like ultimatum he was given. And it's kind of sad because it's like, why do I have to leave home? You know, like why am I forced to choose between, you know, but it's not that sustainable for someone who has career ambitions, it seems, to just stay in Taiwan anymore.
Well, so. I think that your cousin is already one of the lucky ones because he's in tech, and there's a growing wider chasm of possibilities between the people who are able to make it in this new economy and those who aren't, right? So if you are in tech, or if you, have a lot of charisma and you can be an influencer, there's still a lot of opportunities. But I think for most people, most young people, there's a feeling that there's a real lack of quality opportunities. And I think the saddest way this is manifested is that, you know, there are all these scams getting young people to go to Myanmar. And
oh, my God. Yes.
Horrifying, right? They're locked up.
It's like a horror movie. It's crazy when you get kidnapped and rolled into one of these like mega sort of like scam farms.
Exactly. It's like you're a slave to a scam farm, and you should consider yourself lucky if you don't get your organs trafficked or something horrible like that.
Does the phrase sazupan, does that describe the kind of scams that they're doing out there?
I'm not too sure, but it sounds a little bit like it. But here's the terrifying thing I'm going to tell you is that some of those young people were not scammed, meaning they felt so in despair about
I know what you're going to say,
that they're just like, well, it's horrible, but at least it's work. So they went with their eyes open to a horrible crypto slave farm, scam farm.
Where you could get killed if you try to leave, I've heard, right?
Absolutely. Like, you absolutely can get killed, disappeared. So, I think the lack of opportunity, the sense that you can't get on the housing ladder anymore, or it just really saps the vitality out of the society. And I think that's why a lot of the young people are really turning away from the DPP, because they feel like they're just talking about love Taiwan, but they don't talk about how to make Taiwan better.
So you connect this. This may be why your recent your recent tweets have caught some controversy, because you're tying this to democratization, right? You're tying this to, and now here's the thing, like last time I was in Taiwan wasn't that long ago. It was 2019. It was pre-COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the midst, I think that was, if I recall, that was the re-election campaign time of Tsai, when she was going up against Han Guoyu, if I remember correctly. And that was a very hotly contested, more so than this last one.
Yeah, and people forget that. People forget that. Well, actually, I wasn't here for it, but this is what I heard, that Han was amazingly charismatic. And I think he really hits that sweet spot of being very Taiwanese, being able to connect with the locals, and very practical. And it's like, everybody's going to make money. He's got that humor, but it doesn't conflict with the whole KMT vibe in a way that I feel like Hoyoi, his localness does kind of feel a little bit uncomfortable against the KMT vibe. So he was a great candidate, but he was a little early. So in Taiwan, there's like a huge taboo for some reason that I don't think exists elsewhere, but in Taiwan, it's considered very, very, very bad form. If you get elected to mayor and then quit your mayorship to run for higher office, it's
because it's too transparent, like that you just used it as a stepping stone or something.
People see it as a betrayal. People feel like if we elected you as mayor, it's because we want you to serve out your term. You can serve out your term and then run for office.
So if I recall, he was the mayor of Kaohsiung in the south. So he was, less of a more of a green, like a deep green area. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it was, they called it the Han fever, you know, because he was so popular. Now, I actually wasn't here for this part of it, so I can't vouch for it. But at one point, Tsai Ing-wen was looking like such a lame duck that actually Lai Ching-de mounted a leadership challenge. There was a palace coup.
Within the same party, yeah.
Yeah, within the same party. And he did it so sneakily, too. He came at the queen. He missed. And he got to be vice president for the rest of her term.
Yeah, I got to say, I was, you know, I'm quite checked out of all this stuff. I mean, I follow it just tangentially through.
Why follow it? It's so meaningless and pointless and so enraging. Here, let me get to the heart of the issue. Why did I get so enraged that I came out blistering against the DPP? It's because I work in energy, right? And I work in pro-nuclear activism because Taiwan has these nuclear power plants built during the KMT years that are really needed right now. Because we're supposed to be embracing our AI future. That's a lot, according to our president, Lai Ching-de, right? He said Taiwan needs AI sovereignty. Well, I ask, how do you get AI sovereignty when you can't even site a 5-megawatt data center anywhere in North Taiwan because we are short power? So it's nonsense. It's ridiculousness. But he is continuing with the DPP's anti-nuclear homeland program. And that's why, you know, as of now, there's no more nuclear power on Taiwan. That just happened minutes ago. And I'm telling you, it's enraging because that one plant, the last reactor that shut down today, Ma'anshan Unit 2, that was 3% of the grid, the whole grid. So imagine if you had Ma'anshan 1 and 2 and Guoshan 1 and 2 and Jingshan is marginal, don't even count those. You know, it's a pretty good chunk of electricity we can bring back to the grid really, really quickly. Let's say it's 10%. We can bring it back relatively quickly, serve our data center needs, allow us to grow, or even burn a little bit less coal. But the DPP just won't do it. And
are there deeper politics attached to this? Because I know,
of course, there's deep politics.
Let me guess. Because
go on.
I know that there are these half built wind farms. I've seen them, and they don't. I've heard that a lot of that is sort of forced reinvestment of Taiwanese surpluses back into, the U.S. green industrial sector, so buying turbines and stuff from GE, et cetera, as part and parcel with Taiwan's sort of like obligation, basically, to buy U.S. military hardware. And it seems like nuclear energy is like not part of the desired mix. And
you're in luck, my friend, because I... Mm-hmm. Might still be Taiwan's top offshore wind influencer. It was my full-time job a while ago before I got into nuclear. And I realized that wind was a pretty retarded way to get power, especially in Taiwan. But you got the cause and effect backwards.
Okay.
First, the DPP needed to get rid of nuclear. They needed to get rid of nuclear. That was their first prerogative because being anti-nuclear has been foundational to their platform ever since the party was formed in 1986.
Why is that?
Just a few months after the Chernobyl disaster. So first of all, we have this path dependence historical coincidence that anti-nuclearism was just in the air because this first big accident happened and a lot of people died. Like Chernobyl was the most serious, and I would argue the only truly serious nuclear accident. So I can totally understand that. They actually wrote it
Fukushima.
Fukushima. Nobody died from radiation in Fukushima, though. I just feel like if everybody just stayed where they were in Fukushima, like most of the damage is from the tsunami, and nobody would have died from the radiation. But let's not get off topic. So the DPP was formed in 1986, right after Chernobyl. So anti-nuclearism was in the air, so they wrote it into the party constitution. And then they found that the nuclear power plants were just really politically convenient as a symbol of the authoritarian contamination of the Taiwanese landscape. You start getting themes about purity versus contamination and consent versus the technocrats just doing whatever it is that they wanted to do, rolling over the will of the Taiwanese people. And these nuclear power plants, instead of being understood as something more like TSMC, which is like this precious asset handed to you as you take power for nothing, instead of being understood in that frame, they were seen as something to be extinguished and expunged as a symbol of authoritarian rule, and kind of not be pure and clean until they were gone.
This is fascinating. I've never thought of it from this perspective, but this seems it might be the case that this is like a sort of global scale political phenomenon too, because we had a very, very strong anti-nuclear movement. It was more of a left. Mm-hmm. It was more of a, I would say, left-wing progressive movement that saw nuclear not necessarily as authoritarian, but as environmentally, disastrous, and it was very heavily encouraged. Actually, this was not a dissident movement. This was like a mainstream, the country's going in this direction movement. And I think similar things happened in Europe, and it was really like sort of like constantly socialist, socialist rooted France that didn't denuclearize. And so are you seeing a pattern between sort of like socialist left governments favoring nuclear and of US led sort of saying maybe we should go back to fossil fuels or something?
No. First of all, you got France completely wrong. Mm. France built its nuclear power plants under the Mesmer plan. Mm. And this is like De Gaulle's France, okay? Mm-hmm. This is like very dirigiste, very state, like very like more similar to the KMT than to the TPP for sure. Mm-hmm. And it's that container of the strong state that allows you to plan the stability of allowing you to plan all this whole nuclear program that can be undertaken on a state level, right? Mm-hmm. France built 45 nuclear power plants, I believe, in a stretch of 15 to 20 years. This was in the 70s and 80s. I don't remember exactly. And they're still living off that decades and decades later. I believe something like 2/3 of their electricity is still nuclear.
Yeah.
Actually, you can do it in a democracy too. Sweden did the same thing. But that was more of a socialist democracy. Or social democracy. I think socialist is loaded. Social democracy, Sweden. They did it in 15 years. They built 12 nuclear power plants.
Yeah.
So back, there was a cutoff when nuclear suddenly became uncool to the left in the counterculture. I don't know exactly. Maybe the China syndrome, maybe after Chernobyl, whatever. And nuclear, instead of being seen as the technology of the future, as it was in the 50s, it got this like gross, contaminated, industrial, non-environmental, making Gaia cry kind of image.
Yeah, my American sort of reflex here is just to wonder whether that was an expedient political tool.
Absolutely.
To reprioritize the fossil fuel industry and the oil-based economy,
I think you're reaching a little bit there. I want to get it through to you that the anti-nuclear movement in Taiwan is a grassroots movement. It's very connected to the DPP, and how should I say it? It's core. Don't think about, are they doing it for this external motive or that external motive? No, it's really intertwined in their party identity. I've talked to some DPP people who are really sympathetic to me and said, yes, I can see on a level of reason why Taiwan really needs nuclear power, that it is necessary for our growth, for our security. But emotionally, it is intertwined with Taiwanese identity. It is intertwined with the democracy movement. And of course, you know, sometimes I like to call the DPP basically like, 300 or probably more than that, 3,000 nonprofits in a trench coat. So they really like doing that environmental stuff. They really, you know, are left-coded. They're very in touch with the Democrats in the U.S., that sort of thing. So that's kind of their deal. That's their alliance. So everything else, like the fossil fuel conspiracy theory, I don't really put too much stock into that. But although I think you know, recently.
It is. I think there is some truth to it insofar as the United States goes in terms of our.
First of all, until recently, yes, there is definitely now a lot of pressure for Taiwan to buy more LNG from the United States. Mm. That came, I don't know if it was there during Trump won, but now definitely there is tremendous pressure for us to buy more LNG from the United States, including a co-development project in Alaska. That might be the most expensive LNG in the world. I'm not sure.
Oh, wow.
But, mm-hmm. You know,
and you see, but, you know, I mean, that same pressure exists in Eastern Europe and Ukraine and stuff.
But you know, really, before that, I think in the 2020s, there was very little pressure to buy American LNG for some reason. I know that because we didn't buy American LNG. We bought LNG from the Qataris, from the Australians, some from the Russians before the war. Nothing for Thai Power after that, although independent power producers might still buy some. So we really didn't buy that much from the United States. We're just starting to get pressured to. We had, Thai Power had some very, very nice long-term contracts with the Qataris. We really scored some good deals with them, and we supply them regularly. But we're getting pressured to get off that Qatari gas. And the justification for it, and I think, okay, fair enough, is that the Chinese always have a bigger clout with the Qataris, so they can always put pressure on the Qataris to make them drop Taiwan.
Hmm. I see. Yeah. So where does, I guess, where does that put Taiwan now in terms of, like, the future, like, is TSMC as big a component of the Taiwanese economy as the media really kind of makes it seem? It seems like Taiwan right now, from the American perspective, is almost synonymous with TSMC. And we've had politicians, like, I think Trump is of this view. It's been stated directly by people like Vivek Ramaswamy that Taiwan is of little interest to Americans other than TSMC. And so long, if we can expropriate TSMC to the United States, geographically into the United States, then China can have Taiwan for all we care. This has been openly said, during the election with not a lot of pushback. I don't think that Democrats are necessarily that, like, culturally speaking, Taiwan is irrelevant. You know, it's not Israel. It's not even really Ukraine in terms of the emotional and cultural significance and attachments here in the U.S.
This is what really makes me mad, and what might have pushed me over the edge is that the Americans have, on their side, have made it very clear in their signals that Taiwan shouldn't expect anything from them.
Right.
That they, this is very transactional. They're going to get as much TSMC out as possible, and then they're going to send some drones and go by. That's very clear. They're not trying to fool us. This is the thing that's the most frustrating, is that the Taiwanese people are being asked to fool themselves or be considered disloyal to their country.
Yeah.
The messaging is, you must not doubt the Americans. Literally, it's called Yi Mei Lun. The theory of doubting America. Hmm. And if you say anything like, oh, well, gee, what is our defense doctrine? If, you know, how long are we supposed to hold out? You are doubting America. You're exhibiting Yi Mei Lun. And that is thought of as a conspiracy theory. And it's thought of as ridiculous. And it's thought of as disloyal. And it's pro-China defeatism. And I'm just like, wait a minute, you're telling me that to openly acknowledge what the U.S. are saying, not in code, but to you, acknowledging what it is that they're saying, that's doubting America? No, it's affirming what America's openly saying. So I fear this DPP government is making retards of us all by asking us to perform this doublespeak.
You know, I'm starting to understand what you're saying now, because Yeah, I think that your familiarity with American political discourse now, maybe because of your sort of dual identity, your bilingualism and stuff, you know, and I've always felt this too, on account of being here in America, is I do feel like a lot of Taiwanese really overestimate the attachment or even the awareness that Americans have about Taiwan. And I remember, for example, I have a friend. She was an aide to a senator, Senator McCaskill of New York. And she went a couple times on these junkets to Taiwan, where Taiwan would host an American senator or other sort of like high official as a sort of like quasi diplomatic visit. It's not, but you know, it kind of gave off the appearance. And they would do this regularly, and they would wine and dine like a U.S. senator or whatever. And she knew that, you know, my family's from Taiwan, and so we actually met at Capitol Hill, and then we were talking about it. And she said I was like, oh, how was that trip to Taiwan? She was like, oh my God, she's not Asian. And she was like, oh God, it was the worst fucking trip ever. And I was like, oh, what happened? And she was like, they took us to Kaohsiung. What a shit fucking city. It's so fucking depressing. And she was like, we had these endless fucking banquet dinners and they just kept toasting towards friendship and stuff. And I'm like, who are these fucking people? And then I had to go on board a submarine, this rinky dink piece of shit submarine. It was a complete waste of time. I never want to go back. That was the reaction from the, you know, from the staff of the senator that was sort of wined and dined. And I'm like, do the Taiwanese know that this whole thing is just a joke? You know what I mean? Like,
I think their mistakes have been made. And the thing is, you have to remember our history. You have to remember our history, which is that American aid was tremendously important to the development of Taiwan. And without the Americans, this is historically true, Taiwan would certainly be a part of China a lot earlier. So back when America was strong, Taiwan really benefited off this relationship. So I think for the people growing up during that time, trust in America seems like a really good plan. Good things came from America. Aid came from America. During the Straits crisis in the 90s, Bill Clinton sent a couple of aircraft carriers through the Taiwan Straits. Crisis over. Back then, the advantage of the Americans were unassailable. So even a little bit of support from such a big brother made Taiwan feel safe, protected, and taken care of. And it's very natural to think, wow, if they're so important to us, we must mean something to them.
Mm, yes. Yeah, right.
And this is not the case. And I feel like KMT, they actually have a more realist understanding of what the Americans are about, because they were the party that was dealing with the Americans. So it was Chiang Kai-shek getting woken up at 3 a.m. to be told that, you know, some terrible betrayal has happened. You know, it's always like that. So they kind of knew that the Taiwanese-American relationship was transactional. The KMT have deep institutional knowledge of that. The DPP does not. They were chosen later as the, you know, people kind of forget, like back when the DPP first started, they were considered a bunch of yahoos, and Washington establishment still backed KMT. They didn't like those DPP troublemakers. Remember, Chen Shui-bian was a troublemaker. George W. Bush called him a troublemaker. So it really wasn't until Tsai that America really became enamored with the DPP over the KMT completely. Because Tsai was grown in a lab to be the perfect Taiwanese politician, because she's definitely pro-Taiwan, but she's not going to cause an incident. She's not going to go crazy and declare Taidu. But she does poke at China. She's that thorn in their side. And she keeps the issue very high visibility and paints China in a bad light. I think that kind of feeling that she was very, very not going to cause the incident, but doing exactly what they want her to do. That's why they really loved her. And I don't think they like Lai as much, but they don't have much of a choice. So
often with the pod, like, we'll split the episode into like a free one that just kind of goes out in public, and then we have a Patreon one that we'll do as a bonus. I don't know what your time is like, but I kind of want to get also your thoughts, a few thoughts on China itself, and maybe also your recent tweet about Noah Smith, who's sort of like, I would say he's in the China watching camp.
Yeah,
in the US. So I don't know if you have time, but I'd like to flip over to discuss that a little bit.
Yeah, sure, let's do it.
All right. This is the end of part one of a two-part podcast. The second part with Angelica will be on the Patreon feed. To get access to bonus pods and the Discord, go to patreon.com/planningmag.